Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
Hello and welcome to Word in Your Ear. I'm going to start with a bit of audience participation.
Behind you.
Very good. Very good. For the benefit of listeners at home, somebody shouted, "No, you're not." But the question is, this is a bit of a market research. Who amongst this audience remembers buying a record called Nice Enough? I'm going to ask that question again. Who amongst this audience remembers buying a record called Nice Enough to Eat? Please raise your hand. We've probably got about a dozen raised hands in this room. Would anybody care to venture a guess at what it cost when it came out?
14 and 6?
14 and 6,
that's
says Mark
Allen.
We think we have widespread agreement on 14 and 11.
19 and 11.
So anyway, something in that region, and it was for the benefit of younger listeners, it was what was called a sampler album, and it came out on the Island label. And at 19 and 11 or 14 and 6 or whatever it cost, it was a considerable bargain to those people who would normally have to save up 32 and 6 or more for a full LP record. And it was a sampler of various Island artists. I think Dr. Strangely Strange may have been on it.
Heavy Jelly were on it.
I think Spooky Tooth were on it. I think Heavy Jelly, I
Traffic.
Keep singing that same old song.
Nick Drake.
Nick Drake was on it. But was the first track on the first side, or was it the first track on the second side? I don't remember. 21st Century Schizoid Man by King Crimson.
Yeah.
And it seemed to me that everybody who heard that sampler then went out and bought that long playing record in the Court of the Crimson King, An Observation by King Crimson. And it came out around about the same time in 1969 as the second album by the band, which I also bought. And I'm sure if you'd looked at the two of them together, side by side, you'd have thought, if one of these groups were to be still going in 50 years' time, it would probably be the band, these stolid Canadians, rather than whoever it is hiding behind this extraordinary cover of the first album by King Crimson. But how wrong we were, because the group's still going
still
50
there.
Years later, is King Crimson, and the person who's got a lifetime's occupation of documenting that career is there Boswell, I suppose, who joins us here this evening to talk about his revised edition of In the Court of King Crimson. Please welcome Sid Smith.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
There's Sid's book. Copies will be available later on. Sid will be very happy to sign them for you, not least so he doesn't have to take them back to the northeast of England.
They're heavy.
Because they are very heavy.
Yes.
But we'll start with the usual question, Sid. What technology was there in your house for playing music, and what was played on it when you were a lad?
We had a blue vinyl plastic mono. It wasn't a dance set. I think it was an HMV. I think that's where my mum and dad got it from. And my mum and dad were really into Hollywood musicals.
Yeah.
And a big, big number in our house was South Pacific.
You can't go wrong with South Pacific. No. Do you know you're the first person to ever mention that?
It was South Pacific, and the version we had was a bit like a concept album actually, because it had a book in the middle of it.
Oh right, yes,
yeah, it would. So I remember that vividly, and then my parents were also subscribers to There was a local shop around the corner which did, I don't know, like, it sold radios and things, and you could also join a record club. And we used to have Tchaikovsky and Mozart and things like that, but these were 7-inch EPs.
Right.
They weren't full albums, so you'd get a bit of Eine Kleine Nacht music by Mozart,
right?
You know, but on 7 inches, and the other one was Ace of Clubs label, which I think was a Decca.
It was a Decca cheap label.
Yeah, yeah, but then the major sort of development, probably around about 64, was the advent of the Beatles. I had two sisters. I had one sister was into the Beatles, and I bet you can't guess the other group that my other sister was into. Of course, it was the Rolling Stones. So there was a
lively conversation around the dinner table.
There was immense rivalry, fisticuffs. But for me, it was the Beatles. That was I just kind of picked all that stuff up. And the first album I ever bought was Sergeant. Actually, it wasn't Sergeant Pepper's. The first thing I ever bought with me own money was the EP set of Magical Mystery Tour.
Yeah.
And then I bought Sergeant Pepper's.
So when did King Crimson enter your life?
Oh, this you talk about in the book, a life-changing experience, 1972, was
yeah,
it, in Newcastle?
Well, King Crimson first entered my life with that first album, and that was through my sister, who was the Beatles fan, who then developed who went underground.
Oh, did she?
Yeah, she was a card-carrying member of the underground.
Did she have a great coat?
She had a great coat, maxi skirt,
very
boots.
Good.
And she had the coolest record collection. And she used to go hitchhiking around Europe and
fantastic.
Stuff. She did the whole thing.
Was she
thing.
A student?
No. She was a secretary at Brims, which was a building firm.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
But just lived this other life?
Yeah. She would get secretarial jobs, get enough money, and then head off and hitch around Europe
right.
and do all that. The great thing about my sister hitching around Europe, this is getting on to sort of 71, 72. The great thing about that was she would leave her record collection behind, obviously.
So I
just used to pretend it was mine.
So in those days, I'm almost interested in this. How many records made a record collection?
Ah, well,
probably only about 25.
That would have been an amazing record collection. She probably had about... she probably had about 20 albums,
right?
Which was a lot, I think.
And what were the key contenders?
Well, at the time, she was heavily into John Mayall.
Right.
So she had a bit of the old blues thing going on. And here was something interesting. So you'd listen to John Mayall and you think, oh, yeah, this is great, because I wanted to be in that world, you know? And then there'd be Cream, and you think, this is all good. And then Bessie Smith.
Mm-hmm.
Because CBS were doing these in sort of 69, 70. CBS were doing these sort of double albums. So there was that... the other one she had was Memphis Slim.
Right.
And there's a great album called Blue Memphis, which is a kind of like a concept album by Memphis Slim. It's got all the great UK jazzers and rock players on it. And so that was, you know, that was all through. But my sister got into King Crimson. And that kind of... So that album, and, you know, you look at that first album and you think, fucking hell, what's this like? You know? And actually, it's one of those weird... I was talking to a friend of mine earlier today and we were talking about, like, album covers which are great, but the music's a bit shit.
Name names.
There are quite a few of those.
Oh, yeah, I mean, how long you got? I remember being incredibly impressed by the cover of Argus by Wishbone Ash.
Tread carefully, because my right here is going to... He can sing the whole of Argus.
Well, no, but that's a love affair that only lasted about 20 minutes. I realised the errors of my way.
But I mean, you know, for a kid, you know, I'm looking at the cover of Argus thinking... Wow, that's really, you know, it's really cosmic. It's got a great vibe to it. And then you put it on, it's a thorn on head. You know, it's what?
Yeah.
But the point of the story is with King Crimson's first album, you put on the first track for side one, and it's 21st Century Schizoid Man. And the cover and the music absolutely married up. You know, there was no gap between the two things. You know, the cover art and the music had impact.
Is that still their most famous tune?
Yeah, probably. Yeah, it's.
There can't be many groups where the first track on the first album.
Yeah.
It's still Bad Company.
It's still their best selling album. King Crimson's best selling album.
Yeah, I'm sure album. It is.
You think, hands up in this room, who's got a copy of In the Court of the Crimson King?
Oh, there's a forest of hands.
Forest of hands.
Hands up who's bought it more than three times.
Oh
my God.
A forest.
That's
another
lot of
forest.
People.
So it continues to sell.
Yeah. If Robert Fripp was seeing this here, he'd get a very warm feeling, wouldn't it? Go and buy the same record again.
He would say that. And do you know what? There's a new box set coming out earlier.
There's always another
box set. So yeah, of that album. And what we're doing with this box set that's coming out is we've got every single minute that they spent in the studio in 1969, every single minute that was recorded, the entire thing is going to be released, along with loads of stuff that has never...
Have you been part of the team doing this?
Long winter nights will fly by.
Have you sat... I've got to say, seriously, have you gone into studios and listened to days of kind of... Oh, good grief.
Yeah, yeah.
And do you enjoy it?
Has he got conversation
on it? David says, did I enjoy it? Right. Hands up here who knows an album called Earthbound by King Crimson.
It's fair slightly few. Smaller forest, but
now,
anyway.
It's a badly recorded album.
Right.
And it was recorded on very, very overloaded, overdriven cassette, right? So it's almost unlistenable. But I had the job to go and listen to every single tape from that tour. And then I had the job of putting together the 2-CD reissue with all the extras and all the rest of it. It took days and months. And there's a friend of mine who is, you know, who's come into the process, and he's spent hours and hours and hours listening through to every single thing. Do I enjoy it? If you'd said to me at school who was my favourite band in 1971, I would have said King Crimson. And then if you said to me in 1971, well, don't worry, because in 2020, you're going to be paid to listen to this stuff and you're going to make a living at it.
Yeah.
Fuck yeah.
Well, look, let's just go back through the King Crimson story for fans and for relatively superficially acquainted people like myself. Robert Fripp. Key person here. What's his background?
Robert grew up in Dorset with his sister Patricia, who, for the benefit of listeners, is seen here I think, was his photo? Somebody in the audience will know better than me. I think it was taken on Christmas Day, and that's Robert's first guitar.
Oh, I see.
Which had an action that was so high.
Yes.
But he learnt to play it. He was also left-handed, but the guitar was right-handed, and so he just learnt
to
play it.
So degree of difficulty didn't put him off? He was...
He says himself, you know, he was tone deaf and couldn't keep time. And he was, you know, he was left-handed and the guitar was right-handed. What Robert had, even at a tender age, was he had a kind of a discipline to kind of just figure out the problem. And work. He had a even at that age.
Was that discipline manifest in other areas of his life or just in music?
He was at school. Robert was a pretty good all round pupil. You know, doing very well in all his subjects. His father was an estate agent, Welsh and Locke, based in Wimborne, and Robert was kind of going to go into the family business. But he really wanted to be a musician. That's really what his love was. But, he felt the dutiful son. He had to go and he had to, you know, go and train to be an estate agent. He went to business school in Bournemouth. And he did it for a while, and then he just kind of had to go and tell his mum, I can't do it.
And he spent 3 years in a kind of dance hotel band.
Oh, sure.
Bournemouth Hotel.
Well,
he
took over from Andy Summers. That's where Andy Summers worked.
Oh, okay.
And when Andy Summers went off to join Dan Talion's Chariot.
Yeah, Zoot Money's big roll band. It became In All Money.
Yeah. Robert took over, and of course, that kind of education where you're having to, you're sight reading,
absolutely.
And you're playing classics, you're playing foxtrots, it's a good grounding, harmonically and technique as well. You know.
So, who were his musical favourites as he was growing up?
Well, Robert talks about listening to Elvis. And Scotty Moore, and the way he puts it, if Robert was here, Robert tells an anecdote about listening to Scotty Moore and his life changing, you know. So it was kind of in some of the earlier bands that Robert was running in the 60s, you know, they were playing. What were the instrumental groups like? Not the Sputniks.
Tornado,
yeah,
Ventures.
Yeah. Ventures, yeah, that's it. Somebody probably checked.
Right.
But so it was kind of pretty conventional stuff, you know, but all good, all about technique, you know, and learn and acquiring, not realizing in some cases that maybe the tape speed had been speeded up, you know.
Right. Yes. But and you were trying to do the impossible.
Yeah. But then managing it, you know.
Yeah.
And then they kind of Robert, you know, he was going to leave. He wanted to join a band, and so he answered an advert, which had been posted by two brothers called Michael and Peter Giles, and they'd been in a band called Trendsetters, who were actually quite a successful band, you know, on the circuit, like a lot of bands were. You know, guitar, bass, drums, trombone, of course. And keyboards.
Yeah.
And anyway, the two Giles brothers wanted to do something a bit more groovy, you know. So they put an advert for a singing organist. And Robert applied, being a guitarist who doesn't sing.
Perfect, got the job.
And so the three of them
all sorts of odd things. They finished up doing a Dunlop tire ad or something.
Yeah, they did.
That's right.
Oh,
yeah.
God, one of my holy grails is to try and find when I was writing the book. When I was doing the book originally, it was originally published in 2001, and one of the jobs I came so close. I got in touch with the because Dunlop have an archive, you know, of all of their adverts and so on and so forth, and I tried, you know, we got so close, never found the footage of the thing. But what I did find was I found a set of stills taken from the photo shoot. So by then they were joined by the Giles and Fripp were joined by. A guy called Ian MacDonald, who'd just come out of the army, and he'd missed the swinging 60s. He was in British Guiana when the swinging 60s was happening. But he was a really good instrumentalist who could play anything. He could play that table.
Right.
Giles and Fripp and Ian MacDonald, the four of them, kind of were the seeds
of King
Crimson. Were sort of the seeds of King
Crimson. So when are we talking about here? 67?
68. 68 is when they're kind of coming together.
Right. And do they meet Pete Sinfield at this time?
Well, Pete Sinfield comes into the story. They were writing songs, and Ian MacDonald said, well, I've got a mate who writes words, and that mate was Pete Sinfield. So
who wasn't really he didn't really contribute musically, did he? It was mostly just the lyrics.
Peter would disagree with that assessment. I think.
Oh, would he?
I think you know, Peter was Peter would come up with lots of ideas, but Peter's primary function was to supply words and illumination
and lights. That's right.
Yeah.
But he's in all. I mean, he was an official band member, wasn't he?
Yeah. He became an official band. Yeah. He originally started out as a roadie, And providing a few lyrics here and there, but then he hustled, as Peter told me himself, he hustled his way into it.
Yeah. But it was not uncommon at the time, was it? Keith Reid was doing the same
from Broken Arm. Yeah, yeah.
And Robert Hunter.
Robert Hunter for The Dead, and Pete Brown for Cream, really.
Pete Brown, very much so.
Yeah.
And I think for that period, the other thing that should be mentioned about Peter's contribution, and I don't think you can really... what Peter had was Peter was the only one out of any of them who was really a hippie or something near to being a hippie. The rest of them, and like Robert didn't know what was going on. Michael Giles certainly didn't. Maybe when Greg Lake eventually comes into the band, Greg Lake's got a bit of a kind of a thing going on and knows a bit of fashion sense, etc. But it's Pete Sinfield who tells them what to look like.
That's really interesting, isn't it? Because they became...
Style guru.
Really quickly the hippest band in Britain, didn't they? In weeks.
I've written a lot about this band over the years. And every now and again, you know, somebody will commission you to do a job and they want you to do something about 1969, you know? And so you sit down, you think... The first thing you think is... I've got nothing to say that I haven't said a million times before. But then you look at that, you look at what happened, just sometimes running through the dates, you know? And it was phenomenal. I might get some of the dates wrong, so don't give us a hard time, people. But in November 1968, December 1968, Greg Lake gets the call. Greg Lake, at this point, is still a guitarist. And he gets the call from his old mate, Robert Fripp, to join the band, but he'll have to join as a bass player because we don't need two guitars in King Crimson. So Greg Lake comes in December 68, right? In January 1969, so all of the players are now there, right? They're all present. And they're all living in various bits and places in London. And on January the 10th, 1969, Pete Sinfield finds a cafe on the Fulham Road, which has a basement, and so they've got somewhere to rehearse. And on January the 13th, as everybody knows in this room who's a King Crimson fan, January 13th is the first King Crimson rehearsal, right? So that's January 13th. Within about 3 weeks... they've got like a queue of record companies wanting to see them because the word on the street is that this band are amazing. Their music is head and shoulders. There's no bluesy vamping going on. There's nobody jamming on a chord. This music is incredibly structured. But the amazing thing about Crimson at the time was they've got that kind of they've got the kind of claw hammer effect, you know. You can bash the nail in, but you can also pull the nail out very carefully and with a bit of precision. And Crimson had that. The other thing that Crimson had is they actually had financial backing.
Yes.
Because how could you afford a Mellotron in 1968 or 1969 rather? How could you afford to buy all of that really expensive equipment?
And didn't they record their first album and pay for it themselves? Am I right?
The clever thing about King
Crimson... They could shop it around.
The clever thing about what Crimson did was... So Ian MacDonald, who's the instrumentalist who had been in the army, he had an uncle who was an industrialist. And so... I've seen the agreement. So they did an agreement, and they put themselves on wages. And what the idea was that, because Robert had the view that we should all be, this is the only thing we should be doing. So I don't want anybody playing in a Palais dance band like Michael Giles was to earn a bit of extra money. You know, so they all put themselves on a decent wage through this financial backing. They bought the very best equipment they could buy. So everybody had top-flight guitars, drums, Mellotron, as I say. And then they had somewhere to rehearse. And that's what they did. By the time, I think, where are we? February, March, March, they play their first ever performance, albeit not booked as King Crimson, in Newcastle.
Oh, right.
Aye.
The whereabouts?
They did it. They played at a nightclub called Change Is, which was owned by Bob Monkhouse.
Of course. The Monkhouse connection.
The Monkhouse connection. And so then they came back. So that's the end of March, right? And then in April, they play their first gig in London. So their first gig, there's people in the audience. There's members of Yes and various other people, and their jaws are dropped by the precision and the pace and the musicality and the sheer brute force of this band. And as I say, even by the Moody Blues in April are trying to get them signed, and the Moody Blues say, we want to sign you to our new forthcoming label. And they're thinking, great, yeah, that'll do. We'll have some of that. Now, you have to pause for a second and remember, the Moody Blues weren't just any old group. The Moody Blues were a huge, best-selling, gold, platinum, disc-selling outfit. But they wanted to sign King Crimson to their new label. And the Moody Blues had a producer called Tony Clark. The kind of fifth member or the sixth member of the band. And so for a short while, Tony Clark was on board to produce their first album. Now, this is April, and we're already talking about the first album. And there's some talk that it's going to be a double album. And so by the time we get to April, May, June, we're in the studio. In May, we're in the studio, Morgan Studios, with Tony Clark producing. You know, they've done a handful of gigs. Nobody knows who the fuck they are. They're not, like, in the industry. They're not even on the... They're not faces on the scene. And then they're doing this session with Tony Clark. It's not working out. It's too expensive at Morgan Studios. So they move to a cheaper studio called Wessex Sound. And they do sessions with Tony Clark there. And then the band decide that they just don't like Tony Clark's sound. So the band say, thanks for all your hard work, Tony, but we're going to do it ourselves. And they're, you know, I mean, think about that. What's the average age of this band at the time? They're probably 22. Michael Giles is a bit older, but, you know.
Nobody was much older than in those days.
But the point is, that takes some balls.
Yeah.
Now you can't hang out in a London recording studio without some backing. So what the King Crimson managers David Entoven and John Gayden did was David Entoven, both ex-Herovians and moneyed. What they did was they used to work for Noel Gay, the Noel Gay organisation, and what they did was. David Entoven remortgaged his apartment in, it was a Muse apartment, and with that money, put the money up to pay for the recording, and then they shopped it around.
And they ended up on Ireland.
The coolest record label.
I put it to you that if they'd ended up on the Moody Blues label, we wouldn't be talking about them now.
Absolutely, you're totally right about that.
Completely the same music.
The association with
Ireland made a huge difference to them.
I interviewed a few people.
And being on that sampler made a massive difference.
Absolutely.
Huge difference.
I interviewed a couple of the executives from Ireland, and they said when... the first person who went to see King Crimson down to their basement, this was back in the sort of February, was Muff Winwood.
Right, yeah.
And Muff Winwood's... tell me, what this great band, what they sound like? He said, well, they're a bit like the Tremolos. Anyway, I interviewed some other people from Ireland Records who told me that they just totally disregarded Muff Winwood's opinion, went down and heard themselves, and everybody at Ireland knew that they had to sign this band.
It must have been Muff Winwood's way of just killing interest in any band. Yeah, they said
you'd love them. Yeah.
There was a bidding war broke out. This is a band who at this point have no, they don't have a song out. I think by this time they've done the John Peel session.
Yeah, and John Peel described them as the greatest band in the world, or something.
Yeah, something. I mean, you know,
well, they got all these other artists to write their ads.
That came a little bit later, and that was part of
Pete Townsend.
Pete Townsend wrote that was in the September. He wrote it, and the idea behind that was Island Records had this idea that what they didn't want to do was they didn't want to sort of cheapen the dignity of the music by writing anything as sordid as PR.
It's great.
Yeah.
So their idea was that they would only promote their albums by giving it to essentially peers to like a peer review process almost. Yeah, yeah. You know. So the idea didn't really take off, and I think Pete Townsend's about the only one who did it.
Right.
But that's why that
really the original though.
It's really, really, really good idea. Yeah.
But they also were on the bill with the Rolling Stones.
Well, the Rolling Stones thing was a game changer. Absolutely, they were.
And the manager tried to bribe them their way out of the.
Yeah,
didn't have to.
I mean, David Enthoven had a suitcase full of money, £500, because he knew that they had to be on the bill with the Stones, and to his eternal credit, Peter Jenner just said no. I won't have your money, but I will put the band on, because he'd heard good things about them. There was so much word of mouth about Crimson, and that completely
changed things, didn't it?
Well, by this time there was starting to be an appearance in the press, you know, but it was Hyde Park changed everything for them, and. You know, I hope there's no Rolling Stones fans in the audience who will be offended by this. But do you think the Stones were any good that day?
Well, they're the Stones, aren't they? I mean,
but were they any good? I'll tell you who was good that day. It was King Crimson. They got a standing ovation.
Right.
They blew the Stones off the stage. And they were the only band who got a standing ovation that day. I mean, by the time the Stones got on, of course, the crowd were going bonkers. But Crimson were what happened after that was they were playing the Marquee, and then they walked to Hyde Park on the Saturday, and then they got on and they played the gig, and then the next night they were doing the Marquee as part of their regular residency, and how things had changed was. Ian MacDonald kept a diary for 1969, which is an amazingly useful device. If you're going to chronicle a rock band, make sure that one of the members keeps a diary.
Which in those days, lots of them did.
Absolutely.
Ronnie Woods made a living out of it.
In Ian MacDonald's diary, I'm paraphrasing, but after Hyde Park, the next night is at the Marquee, and, you know, did gig, washed hair, got up, washed hair, blah, 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 did gig. Went to the Marquee, did gig. 9 chicks came home with me.
Let's talk about this extraordinary business of the cover of this record. Because by common consent, this is one of the things that sold it. This is the days there's no video, you know, there's nobody's on telly or anything like that. How do you get some kind of visual excitement into the marketplace? You do it with album cover.
Yeah.
So this is a unique piece of work, isn't it?
Yeah. Pete Sinfield has to take some credit for this. I mentioned earlier about Pete was a bit of a style guru. So the guy who did this painting was, it's a self-portrait of a guy called Barry Godber. And Barry knew Pete because they worked at Lion's Tea Rooms.
All right.
But not the Lion's Tea Rooms itself. They weren't Clippies or anything. Or what are they called?
Nippies.
Nippies, sorry. Clippies are bus conductors, aren't they?
Yeah.
Not to be confused.
All this in an education too, isn't it?
Anyway, and so they're in Wessex Recording Studio, and they need a you know, they're nearly finishing their album. Have we got a cover? Well, I've got a mate who can paint.
Who does a bit of painting.
He'll do. Great.
So Barry's a fan of the band, you know, and he's seen them play and all the rest of it. So he's coming to gigs and stuff. So Barry has a pretty good idea of what the band sound like. There's no brief. There's no design brief or anything, you know. So Barry comes in one day. The band are rehearsing. They're actually. This is a true story. They're in Wessex Recording Studio, and they're working through 21st Century Schizoid Man. There's a knock at the door. Barry Godber eventually comes into the large hall down there where they're all there, and he's carrying this big bit of cardboard wrapped in brown paper, and the band stopped playing, you know, and comes in, puts it on the floor, and the five of the members of the band and a couple of other people sort of stand round, you know, and they're looking down at this. They're looking down at the painting, which has become known as either the Screaming Man or the 21st Century Schizoid Man. And they all think, wow. Apart from Michael Giles, who doesn't like it.
Right.
Barry Godber's done another painting for the inside cover, which is a slightly more benign kind of image. And if they'd gone with that as the outside cover, I think the other thing that you were saying earlier, David, is it wouldn't have worked.
No, wouldn't.
But that works.
Because you make the point in the book, which is a really good point, that doesn't have their name on it. And so you have to open up the double album to find out who it's by. So you've already kind of entered their world.
Yeah, yeah.
You're already kind of captured by it.
And there was a bit of controversy about it, because Ireland wanted the name on the band, on the cover, you know, as record companies will want to do, you know. And the band said, no, we don't want that. And Ireland really pressed them hard about it. And in the end, they said, look, this is a deal breaker. You don't put our name on it. And if you do put our name on it, we're not going with Ireland.
Right.
And there had been a bidding war. So Crimson could have walked with somebody else. It would have been a disaster if they'd gone with another label. Ireland were absolutely the right label. And the people at Ireland that I've talked to are in absolutely no doubt, they've told me, that without that record, kind of laid the foundation for a lot of Ireland's...
I'm sure it did.
And David... I've forgotten his name.
Betteridge. Domlio.
Yeah, David Betteridge, I think. They were trying to... Tim Clark was a production manager. So his job was to make sure LP sleeves got printed. And they couldn't keep up with the demand for it. And the other bit of the demand was, which I've mentioned in some sleeve notes, and you mentioned in your book, A Fabulous Creation, available in all good bookshops, is that this record looked great in a shop window.
Yeah.
It was absolutely astonishing.
Yeah, record shops did the whole window.
So Tim Clark told me they were forever ferrying empty album covers
to
various shops. Rhett Davies, who later produced the King Crimson album, he used to manage a branch of Harlequin
something like that.
And he famously got a big joint and sort of put it kind of coming out of the mouth in his window display.
Moving forward in the story here, we're looking at a contrasting album cover here that is a particular favourite of Mark's and mine.
McDonald and Giles.
This is McDonald and Giles, because during the first tour of the United States that King Crimson do, they kind of all leave, don't they?
Well, these guys leave.
And go and make a solo record on which they appeared, you know, looking fabulously handsome with their two fabulously handsome girlfriends.
Yeah.
And every you know, young man...
Any teenager like us would have just looked
just
at
that. Thought, that is the life.
I want to be in this picture.
I used to go to record shops just to look at that cover.
And it was a catastrophic failure, wasn't it, the record?
Yeah.
Brilliant cover, but it was sold about 9 copies.
It was Island Records' most expensive recording to date. It took weeks to record. There was immense pressure on the band, on MacDonald and Giles to finish it. And Ian MacDonald didn't want, you know, he wanted to make it perfect. And of course, you know, that's problematic for all sorts of reasons. And when it came out, it didn't sell.
Despite the cover.
You would think.
You would have thought.
And the interesting thing about the cover, it's kind of happy and it's lovely in one way, but it sort of tells it's. Ian was desperately in love with Charlotte Bates, the girl there, and left King Crimson basically to be with Charlotte because he was out in America for 6 weeks and he was desperately missing Charlotte. And Charlotte was flown out to New York for 2 days to kind of try and, you know, keep Ian happy. And then she had to go home, and so he then entered into a further pit of depression because he was missing her so much. And within a few weeks of that photograph being taken, of course, they split up.
They split up.
Mary Land, who is seen with Michael Giles here, Mary Land played the groovy chick in the Dunlop advert.
Right.
That's where Michael Giles met Mary Land, on the Giles and Fripp.
Okay.
That's where Mary Land was a quite a noted actress in the West End at the time as well. Her career, and the pair of them kind of eventually split up as well. So bit of a sad story.
So, but by the end of the tour, Greg Lake is on his way, not far from being on his way, isn't he, to join Emerson, Lake & Palmer?
Well, the Nice were on tour, King Crimson, I should say, were on tour with the Nice.
Right.
And so MacDonald and Giles leave Crimson. Greg Lake's thinking, I wonder what's going to happen here. Half the band's left. And at the same time, Emerson's thinking about sacking Lee Jackson and Brian Davison of the Nice because he wants to do something new.
Yeah, yeah.
And so it takes them a while to get round. Greg Lake kind of plays it cool. Greg Lake actually records another album with King Crimson. But the second album in the Wake of Poseidon, but then he leaves.
But it's still astonishing reflection on the times, isn't it? That people left a band who was so hot in those days. You know?
Absolutely. It's a decision that they've both told me on numerous occasions that they regretted, and it wouldn't be something they'd do now. You know, nowadays, they take time off, they talk about
it.
You know. But at the time, the other thing about it is sometimes when you're younger, and you're in the moment, you're not worried about kind of things like, well, is this the right decision to make?
No, you're just
going to make the decision.
Yeah, sure.
You know?
Yeah.
So it's they weren't driven at all by, none of them were driven by any thought of money.
So it becomes, you know, it's Robert Fripp's group.
Eventually,
it becomes like a sort of football team with constantly changing members, and he's the kind of manager. And do you think he was cut out for that kind of role? I mean, you never get the impression early on that he was, you know, that was his thing, that he was really a musician.
Robert, actually, you do get the impression that he was cut out for that role, in fact, because if you look at through the press clippings, Robert very quickly becomes the spokesperson for the group. Even in early 1969, a lot of everybody's interviewed in varying publications, but there's a fairly consistent voice of Robert in a lot of these interviews with, like, International Times and other publications. So Robert, when the band falls apart, you know, Robert's decision is, well, I've got to keep this going because this music is important to me. And the other thing about it's worth saying that the first album isn't a Robert Fripp album by a long chalk. If that album belongs to anybody, I mean, it belongs to the band, obviously, but if it belongs to anybody, it belongs to Ian MacDonald, the first album. Ian MacDonald. Without Ian MacDonald, you wouldn't have an album.
Right.
So Robert Fripp takes... He becomes the custodian of this entity called King Crimson, which is not Robert Fripp, but is this name they've given to this benign force that downloads music into the 1969's world.
I wanted to just move, we're zipping about all over the place. I wanted to just briefly digress into the subject of Robert Fripp as a valued collaborator outside King Crimson, because he's recently instigated an action over royalties for David Bowie's Heroes, hasn't he?
And very supported by Brian Eno. Brian Eno has made statements.
And Tony Visconti.
Yeah, saying absolutely right. He completely changed that record.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that part doesn't... The main theme of Heroes, when the music starts before the vocals come in, that main theme did not exist until Robert Fripp flew in and plugged in his Gibson Les Paul into the desk, and Tony Visconti said, "Go."
Yeah. And they couldn't believe what they heard, could they?
No, they couldn't. And Robert, I think Robert heard. Oops, sorry, Robert heard a pass. You know, so roll the tape. Let's hear it. Right, it goes like that. Right, okay. Now go. And that's the line.
Is that
he came
a new
up with.
Legal action, or is that one that he had before?
It's
revived.
It's not a legal action.
It's
per
not.
Se,
no, but it's looking for featured artist status.
Yeah, it's basically just about publishing and
oh, okay.
It's about
royalties,
Heroes
yeah.
getting played millions of times around the Olympics and things like that. You
yeah,
know?
Yeah.
So
yeah,
generating
yeah.
enormous amounts
of money.
Which he is arguably entitled to a bit of.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, you. In an ideal world at the time, he probably should have got a writing credit, maybe.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
But where we are with it is, the various players are supportive of Robert. I mean, if David Bowie was around,
he
would be supportive as well. I'm sure he would.
So let's talk about your extraordinary tome.
Aye.
Which
has a wonderful quote on the cover. It says, "Sid Smith's opinion is worthy of respect, Robert Fripp."
He
just high praise indeed.
He gushed.
Yeah. I thought it was hilarious.
So the first book was completed and published in when? 2001. And did you think at that point, it's all over?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, in 2001, I don't know if I thought it was all over, but because the band was actually on tour, and where that first book left off was the band, I can't remember now, but the band were somewhere in America, and it was, you know, the email was relatively newish at that point. And just as I was finishing the book off, I would get the odd email from Robert, answering a query or something. But the book ends with the band still out on tour. And, you know, come 2003... the band kind of pretty much splits up, and I thought that was it. You know, I didn't expect King Crimson to really return, but they have a habit of disappearing and then returning.
And you've been on tour with them.
I have, yes.
When?
Well, I've been on tour with them a few times here and there, but the longest run, I did some work with them in 1998. That was around the west coast of America. And that was that wasn't King Crimson per se, because what happened in the 90s was King Crimson at that point was a sixth piece, and things weren't going so well. So Robert had the idea that we'll break down into what he calls fractals, and so the band would break down into trios and quartets, and each one would go out on tour. So I was out on tour with a fractal called Project 4. And there were four projects, and I was with Project 4. So I did a couple of weeks out in the States. And then in 2014, I did the full return of King Crimson, which was extraordinary.
So you did 6 weeks, you would say?
I did six.
This is the new band with the three drummers at the front?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I saw them. It was
extraordinary.
So what's life like on the King Crimson tour in 2014, you said?
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, the
is it Wine, Women and Song, or...?
Yeah, well, it's all of that. And, I mean, one of my jobs was to get the cocaine sorted out. I used to have to chop it, you know. So,
or is it people going to their hotel rooms to read Penguin Modern Classics?
I'm afraid it is, you know.
Yeah.
Gentleman of a certain age?
Yeah.
Well, you get a couple of the guys in the band will kind of go to the hotel bar, you know, and they'll have a glass or two, you know, But most of them, you know, pretty much go to their room. You know.
Does anybody just wander off into the town and get lost or anything like that?
You get a bit of that.
There's somebody confused.
There is a member of the band, and I will not name him, who sometimes does get lost. But yeah, this is not a good rock and roll story, I'm afraid. There's no wild partying. No. I mean, you know, back in the day. You know, back in 1969, Greg Lake shagged anything that moved, you know. And actually, so did Robert. You know, they all did. But you know, they're, you know, in the 2000s, you know, I mean, they're...
There's a lovely bit where Greg Lake's trying to get Robert to wear more interesting things on stage. Yeah. Tries to get him to wear, is it a top hat or something? Or
he wants him to wear a cape and a top hat.
Ah, it's extraordinary.
He wants to kind of brand Robert as Jack the Ripper, you know.
Weirdly, he didn't go for it.
No, amazing.
I don't know why not.
So is there a manager or anybody like that nowadays? Or is it Robert Fripp keeps it going?
Well, Crimson have a manager, a wonderful guy called David Singleton, who is... probably far too nice and far too intelligent a man to be a rock and roll band manager, but his diplomatic skills are amazing, and his organisational skills are pretty good as well. And combined with Robert, Robert keeps an eye on everything. You know, I mean, Robert will look at the look at the tour receipts. He'll look at the bottom line. He takes it seriously. Having been in so many situations. I mean, how many times you guys must have interviewed hundreds and hundreds of musicians of a certain age, and the one story, and me too, and the one story that we all have in common is, I was ripped off.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
Well, Crimson are no exception to that. So nowadays, you know, Robert, not just nowadays, but Robert will really keep an eye on things. And sometimes he gets a bit of a hard time for that, but I think, well, if I was running a business... And touring a 9-piece band or whatever it is with all the extra crew and everything, it is a business. It's an immense undertaking, and you don't want to be losing money.
Why
would you want to lose money at it? So you know you've got to have somebody who will keep an eye on what's going on.
So how long do you think it'll go on for?
Well, I've got a pal, and the pair of us. I mean, if I had a penny for every time. Him and I have said, oh, well, that's it now. You know, that's Crimson done, you know. So every time I think Crimson are over and done with, you know, back they come. So I would have thought it's 2019, last year, 50th anniversary, that's the end of the band. You know, you bring the band to a final conclusion. And there's a lovely symmetry because, you know, they're playing Hyde Park in 1969, and in 2019, they're playing Rock in Rio in front of, you know, on a televised audience of 11 million and however many millions out in the arena. So there's a lovely kind of symmetry there in some respects. So, you know, that would be... But as far as I know, there are plans for... 2021, even.
You see, because they're in the only profession in the world where you can still do it 50 years later, and there are no recorded instances of people walking away. And, you know, so I should keep your pen at your side, Sid, because the third revised edition, which you will have to take home in a wheelbarrow, I'm sure. But in the meantime, it's been delightful to hear about this story of mere 50 years. Would you please thank Sid Smith?
Thank you.
This podcast was brought to you by The Word.